You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, tensions between Iraq and Turkey increase after the latter announces its troops are fighting in Iraq to retake Mosul from ISIS. Is it a helping hand that Iraqis could do without? My guests Jane Kinnamont and Michael Binion will discuss this and the other top stories of the day, including the landmark trade deal between the EU and Canada that's been blocked by the Belgian region of Wallonia, and
I've even let down my key core constituency, movie stars. Just the other day, Matt Damon said he was disappointed in my performance. Well, Matt, I just saw the Adjustment Bureau, so right back at you, buddy.
We'll ask why Americans seem to think that President Barack Obama is a lot funnier than Hillary Clinton and indeed Donald Trump. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. We don't often do travel news here on Midori House, but right now I should tell you that there are a number of problems with the trains around London Bridge, which mean that one of our guests, Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, will be here very shortly. But luckily, Michael Binion, a Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times, is here already. We're going to begin with a story about the European Union and Canada. The EU's hopes of signing a landmark free trade deal with Canada appear to have evaporated. Just a few hours ago, Belgium's Prime Minister Charles Michel announced that his country cannot agree to the deal, having failed to secure the backing of authorities in the French-speaking region of Wallonia. The other 27 EU members would have been ready to sign the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, otherwise known as CETA, which has been in the pipeline for 7 years. But after spending days in Brussels trying to salvage the deal, Canadian Trade Minister Chrystia Freeland has lost patience and walked out, and it seems as if now Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will not be flying in on Thursday to sign the deal. Michael Binion, this is in some ways shows, it could be argued to say, this shows just how disorganised and complicated the EU is, but it also goes to show just how difficult it is to sign a trade deal with the EU.
Exactly. It also shows, as you say, how difficult it is to get unanimity in all 28 members. Britain is, for the moment, one of those saying yes, because it's still a member of the EU. But a small region of Belgium can hold everything up. And we've seen this before when there have been attempts at passing new treaties in the EU, for example, the Lisbon Treaty and one or two other ones, where one or two countries voted no, and that held everything up because it has to be unanimous. And they simply were encouraged to vote again. Now, I don't think Belgium can be encouraged to vote again because Wallonia is already in, it's not on very good terms with the other half of Belgium. And that's part of the problem, that the country itself doesn't have a unified point of view.
Well, this is it, isn't it? There are a number of regions within Belgium that have to agree for Belgium as a nation to say yes. And that hasn't happened. I guess there are two different types of democratic argument here. One is that, well, all 28 states or all the regions within all 28 states should have to say yes, otherwise that's undemocratic. But then your fear is that one tiny group can hold up something for everything else. I guess the other democratic option is that if the majority say yes, then they should go ahead. And if the minority don't like it, they can always leave the European Union.
Well, you can't ask a small region of a small country to leave the European Union and strike out on its own. That's unrealistic. But you make the point that has been with the EU right from the start, and that is, do you do everything by consensus or do you have majority voting? Now, when you only had 6 members of the common market when it started, you could do things by consensus, and you could wait till everybody agreed. And usually, nearly all decisions, which were not that huge, I mean, they were fairly pragmatic decisions, it was possible to do it that way. as the Union became the European Union, and as it expanded and brought in new members, it became more and more difficult to make sure that every time everything could be done by consensus. So you then had majority voting, but you had a sort of qualified majority, as they call it, so that different weights were given to different states according to their population, so that it sort of represented the real majority of the Union. Now, the problem about that is that, of course, it's much more efficient. Otherwise, in the end, you'd never get anything done. But it does mean that you have to overrule those minorities that may feel that their vital interests are being ignored. And I think this is an absolutely insuperable dilemma. There's no way around that. I mean, it's the same in any democratic state. If you take a vote by parliament and the minority loses, the minority feels aggrieved. But in the end, people say, well, you know, the majority wins.
But in a sense, isn't that then the way... That when you look at how a national democracy works, surely then that is a model for how a continental democracy should work. If one region doesn't like it, well, look, if the vast majority do, then that's kind of tough.
Yes, but that would be easier to argue if Europe was one single country. One country with various regions. But when you don't have a complete union, you have more of a sort of federation, and even then some of the links are not very strong, then it becomes more difficult to say, well, you can be ignored because you're not really part of the main argument. And that leads people to think that the European Union is really a super state, and that doesn't go down very well with its members at all.
How then does the European Union move on from here? Because... this is a trade deal that has taken 7 years to negotiate. It was right at this is the very last moment. As we were saying, Justin Trudeau was preparing to fly to Brussels on Thursday to sign the thing. How does the European Union, A, deal with this treaty, and B, deal with any future treaties trade treaties they might have to organise?
Well, it's obviously intensely frustrating for everybody concerned, for the Canadians, for the European trade officials, for the negotiators, for everybody. There's a temptation to get very angry and wave the big stick at the Walloons in southern Belgium. The pragmatic argument, of course, would be either to buy them off, to offer some sort of inducement to them, and probably that's maybe what they're after. They may be just grandstanding, knowing that they're going to have to cave in the end, but do so at a price. Or you simply make some tiny adjustment to the treaty that you then present it as a different version of the treaty and say, right, now vote again, now try again. And on both of those, one would count on the Belgian state putting as much pressure, political and possibly economic, on the rebellious part of the country as it can, with the help of the sort of big powers in the Union.
And I guess we should also look at what this might mean for any Brexit negotiations, because as has been pointed out by those who are a little more sceptical about what happens next, any deal that's agreed by the EU with the UK, whether that's the deal of how they leave or any trade deal that follows, is, just like this deal, going to have to be signed off by the other 27 nations. And in Belgium's case, all the different regions, including Wallonia.
Well, that is a very daunting prospect for British negotiators, because I think that is exactly what will happen. And I think one of the countries during these marathon negotiations might say, we don't agree because our interests are being overlooked. I mean, somewhere like Germany will have a big say in the negotiations anyway, but some of the smaller ones may hold it up, and Britain may find it's just got to leave with no deal at all.
OK, we'll move on. And I'm pleased to say that the 1741 from London Bridge has finally arrived and Jane Kinmont is now with us in the studio. Now, tensions between Turkey and Iraq have intensified after Turkish leaders announced that the country is engaged in the offensive to retake Mosul in Iraq from Islamic State. Previously, Iraq has objected to the presence of some 500 Turkish troops who are training Sunni, Arab and Kurdish forces at a base near Mosul, saying they are there without permission from Baghdad. Turkey has refused to withdraw them and is insisting it will play a role in the Mosul offensive. Jane Kinnamont, first of all, can we clear up exactly what the Turkish troops are doing or aren't doing in the offensive?
Well, they're providing the training as you mentioned, and in the eyes of some of the regional powers, they're helping to provide a veneer of Sunni legitimacy, because many of Iraq's neighbours are afraid that operations directed by the Iraqi government with significant support from Iran as well as the US will simply alienate Iraq's already incredibly alienated Sunni population still more. But there is a deep distrust between the Iraqi government and the Kurdish, and the Turkish government.
Michael Binion, that distrust between the two governments has been there for some time.
It has indeed, yes. And Turkey is, as Jane says, it is posing as the champion of the Sunnis, which, of course, doesn't go down very well in Baghdad. And the Iraqis are also saying, well, Turkey actually exacerbated the problem in the first place by giving tacit support to IS. I mean, for some long time, it wasn't quite clear which side the Turks were on in the fight against Islamic State. And now they've come in and they want to be part of the action. A whole series of reasons is it's partly big power bravado. They want to feel that they are seen to be the big power in the region. It's partly frustration because they tried various other initiatives before over the Syrian imbroglio and none of them seem to have worked. They've got themselves on the wrong side. It's partly naked self-interest because by being there, they want A, to influence the post-Mosul settlement posing as champions of the Turkmen people, who are a minority in Mosul. And the most important thing for Turkey is to make quite sure that the Syrian Kurds don't maintain a continuous strip of territory all along the Turkish border. So they're going to send the army in to try to break up the hold of the Syrian Kurds.
Jane, as Michael mentions there, Turkey has taken very much a, in the past, well, my enemy's enemy is my friend, or at least my enemy's enemy is someone I'm going to close my eyes to as they slip across my border attitude to what's happening in Syria. Do you think that that attitude has changed, or that they simply see this as, well, this is the best way of furthering our own goals?
I think it genuinely has changed because Turkey, like Saudi Arabia, has been the victim of serious ISIS attacks at home. I think there were many Sunni countries and Sunni people in the region who initially underestimated ISIS, didn't see the risk of blowback despite the many historical precedents. And it was really when ISIS took Mosul that it became obvious to powers in the region that this was a big, powerful force that was beyond any state's control.
Michael, I guess the other issue for Turkey's involvement here is for the Western allies who are involved in this, the Mosul offensive, in that will Turkey be part of this coalition in the same way that they are, or will they have other ideas, as you mentioned, in terms of pushing back against the Kurds, who actually, when you look at, you know, the fight against Mosul, the Iraqi Kurds are on the same side as the Turks.
Well, Turkey is proving a very difficult partner for the Western powers, for America in particular, because the Americans saw the Kurds, both the Iraqi Kurds, in the form of Peshmerga, their armed militia, well, their army, really, and the Syrian Kurds, the so-called YPG, which is the group that Turkey says is in league with the PKK terrorists in Turkey. But these have proved the only really effective fighters against IS. So the Americans have gone along with both the Syrian Kurds and the Peshmerga. Now, Turkey has no problem allying itself at the invitation, they say, of the Peshmerga, because they want to split the Kurds. They're friendly with the Kurds in Iraq. They do trade deals that are very profitable in those, and they'd quite like to see them, in fact, quasi-independent from Iraq. But they don't want them linking up into the idea of a greater Kurdistan with all the Syrian Kurds, because that would simply increase the pressure on Turkey to make more concessions to its own Kurds in the eastern part of the country. So it's a very tricky balance for the Turks, and the problem is that they've proved very difficult partners for the Americans, and of course for the Iraqis, because they're pursuing different agendas. And it really hasn't been very clear which side they've been on for some time. And in fact, sometimes they're fighting the Syrian Kurds, whereas the Americans are arming them.
There's been a lot of fairly sort of gung-ho reporting of the coalition and its offensive in Mosul. Do you think this is a coalition, Jane, that will that will stand the test of time, that can actually stick together for the duration of this offensive, however long it takes, and not either sort of go off their own way or slightly disintegrate and fight against each other?
There is a strong common interest among so many countries in the region and beyond in fighting ISIS that I think the military side of the coalition will be able to remain fairly united. The problem comes in terms of the political stabilisation or lack of it. The Iraqi government really seems to lack a serious plan for how to stabilise Mosul, how to ensure that the local residents who are going to be fleeing this fighting actually feel that they have homes that they can return to. Their record elsewhere is not very good, and they will be getting lots of well-intentioned advice from the Americans, the Brits and so forth. They'll also probably be listening to Iran more than to anybody else. And there's a very high risk of those areas being punished, of revenge, and a lack of reconstruction because Iraq is broke. The fall in the oil price has really hit Iraq badly.
That's the thing, Michael. What happens next? Let's say that ISIS is driven out of Mosul and ISIS leaders essentially go back across the border into Syria. Do Turkish troops go home? Do the Peshmerga stop at the gates outside Mosul and say, "Oh, don't worry, guys. As promised before, we're going no further." What happens next? Does the Iraqi government have any strategy that you can see to try and bring their country together?
Very little. And I think the one thing you can be quite sure of is the Turkish troops are not going home in a hurry. They're going to be there. That's the main point. They're there for the post-Mosul, post-liberation period. And President Erdogan made it absolutely clear that they see a long-term need for their presence and a long-term role, because he said this is an area where we have historic responsibility. Now, Turkey for a long time has had sort of post-Ottoman yearnings or yearnings for its old Ottoman influence and has started looking again at those places it turned its back on more than 90 years ago. It's true, Mosul was a key city in the Ottoman Empire for 400 years, and Turks still think they do have a historic responsibility. So I think they will stay there. Now, the Kurds, of course, will see an opportunity to consolidate and expand their own influence. So they probably will, if they stop at the gates, they're not going to go home. But whether they'll go on further than that, and then you will have to have some sort of deal between the Turks and the Kurds as to who controls what. Meanwhile, I think the Baghdad government is going to be fairly powerless to change things, because although they've got the army right up there, there's not going to be much appetite for the army to maintain the ring. And of course, the danger is that instead you'll get Shia militia bent on revenge.
Who is the broker here, Jane? Is this essentially going to be Hillary Clinton's, assuming she's elected, first real test in January? Is, you know, post-Mosul, how do we make sure that the new Iraq comes to some sort of agreement?
The US is already very deeply involved, particularly through a special envoy and former ambassador, Brett McGurk. I suspect that the next US president is going to have a lot to preoccupy them at home after this extremely polarising election, and getting the full foreign policy team in place is going to take some time. So there is a risk that the senior political leadership in the US could have their eye off this ball, and regional powers will be well aware of that, probably some of them hoping to take advantage of it.
Okay, we'll take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here on Michael 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests Michael Binion and Jane Kinnamont. Coming up next, how to deal with difficult world leaders and who is the funniest US politician of them all. Stay tuned.
Ever since Justin Trudeau became Prime Minister, Canada has been in the spotlight. And that's just one of the reasons why we dispatched our team north for the November issue, to look at everything from diplomacy to architecture, power players to good food. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In design, we venture into Canada's great outdoors. From the rugged coastline of Nova Scotia to the lakes of Ontario, we meet a cast of architects designing handsome homes that work with the wilderness to form a unique structural language.
In the edit section, we highlight the hidden delights of starting a home in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and dig into the growing food scene in Prince Edward County, Ontario.
The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the team.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24. Still with me in studio, Jane Kinnamont and Michael Binion. America's top diplomat for Asia earlier today said something that probably wouldn't have come as much of a surprise to anyone. Daniel Russell, the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, said that the Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's controversial recent remarks have sparked distress in the US. President Duterte has declared his desire to scale back military engagements with the US and has also told President Barack Obama to go to hell. Michael Binion, it has been awkward for President Barack Obama that his famed Asia pivot has somewhat unravelled in the last few days, as Duterte has, yes, told him to go to hell, and also gone to Beijing, said, we're now friends, I don't need the Americans. I mean, the day later, he did then row that back and say, oh, actually, no, I still do need American friendship. But it just goes to show how awkward diplomacy can be when you have a slightly unreliable partner.
It does indeed, yes. Well, he's a populist, he's a wild guy, he's had no training in diplomacy at all, and he doesn't really care about that, because rather like Donald Trump, he bases his appeal on being someone who simply doesn't play by the rules, says things that seem outrageous, but yet cause reaction, and sometimes cause reaction that helps him, and gets elected because he said, I don't care how many drug dealers I kill, we'll just go down and kill them all, and effectively does that, which, of course, provoked a reaction in America, with a lot of people saying that this guy has a miserable human rights record, which is one of the reasons he got so fed up and said, well, go to hell. And he said things much more obscene than that as well. It is a problem. How do you deal with people who are essentially, one hesitates to say it, but gangsters who come into power? You have the unconventional. We've had it in Europe. We had Silvio Berlusconi, who is slightly off the wall at times and says just what he thinks. And that's been hard enough to sort of finesse in the polite diplomacy of modern Western corridors. But how to deal with Duterte? Who knows?
Jan Kinnamont, there are, you know, certain diplomatic rules and procedures that most nations follow. They talk in a certain way, they speak with respect, they don't swerve too vehemently from whatever the perceived national interest had been of from the previous guy. But then occasionally you get curveballs like Duterte, like Berlusconi, like Putin recently. And that's a real challenge for foreign ministries to deal with, isn't it?
It's hard to respond to because you don't want to aggrandise the rhetoric and take it too seriously. And of course, this comes at a kind of silly season period where the US has got its presidential election to focus on. And it's relatively easy to criticise a president who's not going to be the president in a few weeks' time. It's much more common for allies of the US to be polite at international fora, but actually whip up loads of anti-American sentiment within their own countries. We've seen that quite a lot in the Middle East, Pakistan and other places. But this does seem to be taking it to a new level of silly rudeness.
And Michael, one assumes that behind the scenes, the Philippines Foreign Ministry is probably in very regular contact with the State Department of the US saying, well, look, I know he said that, but don't worry, we're still trying to get a handle on him. He doesn't really mean it. We're still sure of our relationship with you.
I'm sure that's exactly what they're saying. Now, the Americans will say, yeah, but it's a bit embarrassing when, you know, he calls our president a son of a bitch or whatever he called him, and things of that kind. And it is awkward. And unfortunately, when the polished and polite diplomats who are used to dealing with the Americans find that they're overruled from the top and he's supported by the crowds below, the crowds in the street, that is, that whatever they say, the Americans say, well, you know, I know that you would like things to continue, but given the lead we're getting from the president, can we really trust what you say? Can we be sure that that is the wish of the country?
This is often sort of talked about in terms of strength and weakness, Jane. And Obama has been criticised for showing weakness across the Middle East and across Asia in the way that he's dealt with political leaders. And he's being criticised for it now, not just by Donald Trump, but by others as well. And yet, is it really weak to essentially turn the other cheek when someone makes statements like this, surely it would be weakness to say, to respond to it and say, okay, fine, we're packing up and we're going home.
I think that's certainly the risk, that overreacting can then seem to sort of bring the US down to the same level as this. And for policymakers, the question will be what is actually happening in terms of Philippines' policy. You know, are there going to be genuine, real changes in how much they welcome an American military cooperation and so forth? Or is this just bluster that actually serves to distract from the relationship not really changing?
Okay, we'll move on. Finally today, are Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump funny? Americans don't seem to think so. Before we continue the discussion on that theme, let's hear what the presidential hopefuls came up with at last Thursday's Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation dinner in New York, an occasion where they are supposed to be funny.
It's great to be here with 1,000 wonderful people, or as I call it, a small, intimate dinner with some friends. Or as Hillary calls it, her largest crowd of the season.
And looking back, I've had to listen to Donald for 3 full debates, and he says, I don't have any stamina. That is 4.5 hours. I have now stood next to Donald Trump longer than any of his campaign managers.
Well, according to a new survey by ABC News and SSRS survey research firm, as many as 40% of Americans think that neither of the presidential candidates are funny. In contrast, 68% said that President Barack Obama was indeed a funny politician. Michael Binion, first of all, do you agree? Out of the three of them, who would you say is the funniest?
Oh, Barack Obama, no doubt, because he's got very good scriptwriters and his sense of timing is very good. The other two, it's okay, you know, they made an effort. I mean, it's a bit lame, but it wasn't so bad. It wasn't sort of cringe-making. But Obama, at the annual White House dinner, White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is the high point when presidents are meant to make a few jokes, but usually at their own expense, and he was very good at doing that. And I've been to those dinners when President Reagan was president, and he was the best of all because he was an actor, so he had the real sense of timing. So what you need to work is a good script, good lines, especially some good one-liners, a sense of timing, and a sense of how to communicate with the audience.
I'm glad you mentioned as well that Reagan was an actor. For anyone who's young enough to think that it's a bit strange that a reality TV star can run for president, America has actually had an actor as president. Jane Kinnamont, does it matter whether a politician has a sense of humour?
It's one way of connecting with people. It's not going to be the important thing that people vote on. But in an age where a lot of people find politicians very bland and boring, then sometimes humour can be a good way to get through that. People used to think Trump was funnier in the earlier stages when he was one of several candidates. A lot of people who were polled said that they thought he was at least entertaining and livening up what would otherwise be very boring debates.
Do you think his sort of abuse of his fellow candidates was seen as more amusing then when it was, well, firstly, it was towards men, and also it was a sense of, like, you know, pricking sort of pompous politicians?
Well, the stakes weren't as high. No doubt some of his supporters still think that his remarks are funny and that people that have objected to them have no sense of humour. But I think also as the race progresses, candidates tend to become less humorous because humour is risky. And they don't want to take so many risks. As you could hear from those samples of so-called comedy, it was much more about scoring political points than actually being amusing.
I think the best humour is when you can laugh at yourself. And that's also a very shrewd way of doing things, because then when something goes wrong and you laugh at it, you're sort of protected by your own ability to laugh with the others at yourself. So they don't laugh at you quite so much. I suppose the classic example in this country is our own present Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, who, when he was Mayor of London, you know, all kinds of things went wrong. When he was opening the Olympics, he got stuck on some wire that zipline, and he was left hanging there, and everyone thought that was terribly funny. But it protected him from criticism.
Arguably less funny when he's Foreign Secretary.
But, indeed.
But there we are. We'll leave it there. there. Michael Binion, Jane Kinnamont, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. I'm Steve Bloomfield. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. Goodbye.